For those whose eyes are weary from gazing after every neighborhood child, and whose hands are thin from longing for a small soft body and a cradle's rocking, Mother Rachel brings healing leaves from faraway mountains and comforts them with a kind word. At any hour, God may open the closed womb.
Welcome to Season 2 of The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. Today, we'll be reading Women's Songs by Kadia Molodovsky. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
The Yiddish poem that we have before us today is by Kadia Molodovsky, who was born in Russia in 1894. It is taken from her first book of poetry, published in Vilna, Poland in 1927, and we have it here in two somewhat different English translations by Irving Feldman and Catherine Hellerstein. The poet was then 33 years old, married, and living in Warsaw at the center of an exceptional Yiddish cultural renaissance. Indeed, at about the same time that the prestigious Kletskin Press published her first book in Vilna, the poet Ezra Korman in Detroit, Michigan, issued an anthology called Yiddish Women's Poetry, with her work prominently represented. Under its newly restored sovereignty, Poland was then briefly allowing its ethnic minorities to develop their own cultural institutions, in response to which Jews had created a network of schools and orphanages, along with the teacher seminaries and children's publications needed to serve them. Kadia, as everybody called her, was a qualified educator and beloved teacher in those schools. But history was taking another turn for the worse. The widespread poverty and overcrowding in Poland's major cities, along with the growth of anti-Semitism and political turmoil, inspired in some young Jews a stronger sense of Jewish national purpose. And along with Yiddish, this period also saw a parallel explosion of writing in Hebrew. As a devoted Zionist, Kadia was close to this Hebrew literary renaissance and would eventually become as well known through translation in Israel as she would be in New York, where she and her husband settled in 1935. Meanwhile, her children's poems, which addressed the ominously threatening conditions of the day, became and remained so popular that they would threaten to obscure her stature as a poet in the Yiddish literary pantheon. If all this sounds like a very complex intermeshing of languages, cities, publications, and political and cultural initiatives, that's just what it was. And Kadia was at its center, writing in several genres, including essays, fiction, and memoirs. In New York in the 1960s, she would co-found a literary journal, Svive, that with one interruption continued until her death in 1975. She would also be posthumously blessed with the devoted translator and biographer Catherine Hellerstein, who has edited a very fine bilingual edition of her selected poems entitled Paper Bridges. Let's briefly back up in order to move forward. Kadia's father had been the first to recognize her intelligence, and he gave her the best education he could, so that she was not disadvantaged in either Jewish sources or general knowledge. Though she was living in Kiev during the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 and had her literary start among a new cadre of Soviet writers, she kept her distance from the hard leftism of the interwar period. While no other writer was as immersed as she was in the daily life of impoverished Polish Jews, she experienced these hardships relatively free of prevailing ideological pressures. In the same spirit, she would resist being pigeonholed as a woman's poet and stayed clear of feminist politics. Other modern writers reveled in the tensions and incongruences of their life and times. Kadia had an integrated sense of herself as a Jewish female poet and well-trained teacher who could be the same person and do the same things, whether in Poland, America, or the land of Israel. The poem we read is in this vein. It's the sixth of 11 grouped as women's poems that range from an expression of penitence for not having waited sexually for her destined husband to a poem in which, with the keenness of a child at a Passover Seder, the poet still awaits the advent of the prophet Elijah announcing the imminent appearance of the Messiah. The opening poem in the group traces what she has absorbed from the past women of her family, while in this poem, the four biblical matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, come in serial progression to comfort other females of the tribe. Farkalis Orme was an Dienstmädlach gewen, zappt die Mutter Sore von Fässer Tunkele und Krugen Finkeldicken Wein. For poor brides who were servant girls, Mother Sarah taps sparkling wine from dark barrels and pitchers. She who is destined to have a full pitcher, to her, Mother Sarah carries it with both hands, and she who is given only a small goblet has Mother Sarah's tears that fall into it. And to the streetwalkers, dreaming of white wedding shoes, Mother Sarah brings clear honey on tiny trays to their tired mouths. Now, the Hebrew Bible is a mighty document, the voice of God delivered through Moses. It is read from a Torah scroll containing the five books of Moses, the most precious and sacred valuable of every Jewish community. In even the humblest synagogue, honor and ceremony revolve around the public readings from the Torah, the thrice weekly centerpiece of the morning prayer service. It has been the chief responsibility of Jewish males to transmit this scroll through reading, study, and interpretation. But from about the late 15th century, Ashkenazic Jews, that is, European Jews east of the Iberian Peninsula, brought the entire Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, into the Jewish home. The invention of printing made it possible, and translation into Yiddish made it all the more accessible. The Yiddish work Tzenarena, composed in the 1590s, presents the weekly readings from the five books of Moses and the prophets, enlivened with interwoven Talmudic legal teachings and midrashim, rabbinic lore. The work's title, taken from the Song of Songs, Tzeno Rena Benot Zion, Go forth and see, ye daughters of Zion, indicates that it was intended mostly for women, though it also became popular with the less educated men, and it did become, by far, the most popular Yiddish book ever published. In keeping with its intended audience, it highlights the women of the Bible and the virtues traditionally associated with them. And picking up on this tradition, Kadya brought the matriarchs home to Poland. As the first of the matriarchs, here referred to as mothers, the Himahot of the Jewish tradition, Mother Sarah, the wife of Father Abraham, looks out for the servant girls who have just been released from domestic service. Traditionally associated with hospitality and kindness, Sarah is also more ambiguously associated with the expulsion from her home of the servant Hagar, lending a touch of irony to her generosity, since in the book of Genesis, she herself, on her own, was the one who discharged Hagar from the family's employ. So if this tenderness of hers is not quite an atonement, it suggests that she wants to do the best for those in Hagar's situation. The Jewish concept of tzedakah, giving, had become so refined that Molodovsky here in these lines picks up on how aid is distributed according to the status of the recipient. Sarah celebrates the most fortunate of these brides with both hands, commiserates with one to whom life accords less, and tries to sweeten the hope of the prostitutes who can only dream of a proper marriage. In each case, the poem uses the term bashert, Wemen sie sa fuller Krug bashert, in the way that Jews speak of matrimony as something predestined. Here, it refers not to the destined bridegroom, but to the luck that determines human fate. Without trying to alleviate their situation, and rather than treating them all alike, Sarah does what the poem itself attempts in acknowledging the reality of these women, equal descendants of those in the Bible, but distinctive and calling for individual favors. The poem continues, "To poor brides of noble birth, ashamed to lay their trousseau of patches under their mother-in-law's eye, Mother Rachel brings camels heaped with white linen, and when darkness spreads out around them and all the camels kneel down to rest, Mother Rebecca measures out ell after ell of linen from the rings of her hand to her golden bracelet." Well, biblical Rebecca is quite different from her statelier mother-in-law. She is the young girl who, when asked by Abraham's visiting servant Eliezer for some water, brings water as well for his camels and is rewarded with the golden bracelet that we see her wearing here. Poverty is not the only kind of suffering. There is also the humiliation of brides who may have been raised in families prestigious enough to get them a good husband, but without a trousseau to match. When the Soviets said, "each according to his need," they calculated in economic terms. Molodovsky's Jewishly informed idea of life does not overlook the importance also of dignity and personal pride. Thus, Mother Rebecca brings fine material to those who are shamed by their fallen status, and again, with a wink at the biblical source, uses her bracelet to measure it out. When it comes to Mother Rachel, the beloved wife of Jacob and third of the matriarchs, we are not surprised to see her tending to those who cannot conceive. Thanks to the speed of advances in medical science, we need reminding that infertility was until recently the greatest tragedy that could befall a woman, and that barren women are among the Bible's most poignant figures. For those whose eyes are weary from gazing after every neighborhood child and whose hands are thin from longing for a small soft body and a cradle's rocking, Mother Rachel brings healing leaves from faraway mountains and comforts them with a kind word. At any hour, God may open the closed womb. Even as she continued to devote herself to the needy children of others, Kadya Molodovsky never bore any children of her own. So we are bound to associate this third section with the poet herself. Weary eyes and thin hands, müde Augen und dürre Hände, normally descriptions of impoverished seamstresses and overtaxed factory girls, here apply to the emotional deprivation of women who cannot enjoy the most basic female pleasure of holding and rocking their infant. Rachel, who herself needed miraculous intervention in order to beget a child, brings to these women the medicinal hope of such intervention, speaking as softly as a mother would lull her child. The poem gradually contracts as it moves along, so that we scarcely notice how the number of lines accorded to these women declines gradually from 12 to 10 and 9 to finally just 5. Even in the hierarchy of need, there is a difference between servant girls who get to be brides and women who remain solitary. Here's the poem's conclusion. "To those who cry at night in solitary beds and have no one to share their sorrow, who talk to themselves with parched lips, to them comes Mother Leah quietly, shielding both eyes with her pale hands." Leah is the matriarch who suffers from not being wanted, the stand-in for her sister Rachel, who was truly loved. The Bible tells us that Leah was unattractive. She had weak eyes, whereas Rachel was shapely and beautiful. Solea comes not to brides or infertile women who may yet give birth, but to the lonely ones who are abandoned, outcast, or simply unclaimed. Whatever their age or circumstance, however, Lea is unable to bring them any comfort. Here, Hellerstein's English version is clearly the truer of the two that we have before us. Zu sehe kommt still die Mutter Lea, halt beide Augen mit die bleiche Hand verstellt. In Irving Feldman's rendition, to them Mother Lea comes softly and covers their eyes with her pale hands. Though he may imagine Lea covering the eyes of the unfortunate women who perhaps are already dead, the plainer meaning is that with pale hands, she covers her own eyes, ashamed of not being able to help those in dire need of comfort. The Bible says that Lea had weak eyes, and Molodovsky seems to allude to this in giving weakness the meaning of not being able to look at the sufferer. This poem, written in free verse, is organized through words and images rather than regular rhyme and rhythm. Hands, that liturgy shows raised in prayer or benediction, here do better by delivering with kindness and delicacy the offerings most appropriate to deprived fellow creatures. Though the poem begins ostensibly with the celebration of marriage, the conditions are those of Polish Jews in the 1920s, as the elevated figures of the Bible descend to visit the back rooms of Warsaw. We hardly know whether the contrast should disturb or comfort us. Does the unbroken chain of transmission cheer, ennoble, reassure, and console its progeny? Here, what it cannot change, it at least gladdens. This poem is also organized through the preposition for, in Yiddish, far, as each matriarch brings something helpful for the indigent or disadvantaged woman. But when it comes to Lea, she has nothing for the women and simply comes to them to be there with them. In the last instance, hands are useless. They have nothing to offer. They can only hide the bitter reality, too painful to behold. The Bible has its miracles, and European folklore has its fairy godmothers, but Molodovsky's generation of Jewish writers no longer expected divine or supernatural intervention in human affairs. And yet, there was still plenty of human suffering. In fact, the troubles facing modern women seemed even greater than when women accepted the comfort of religious faith. Kadya Molodovsky lived and wrote out of a Jewish sense of what European aristocracy called noblesse oblige, the idea that with privilege comes obligation. In this poem, she brings the biblical past to watch over the reduced and broken present. From the beginnings of post-biblical history, Jews had found solace in the writings of their great teachers and poets. Kadya continued that tradition in the harsher, darker conditions of her svive, her cultural surroundings. This poem suggests that the matriarchs still have much to offer, even when there is nothing substantial or tangible or tradable to give. The poem itself, like Leah's presence, becomes the consolation. And that is it for today. Next week, we will be reading Itzik Manger's poem, The Megillah Songs, his version of Megillat Esther. And until then, happy reading.